John, and talk away. Have a seat. So I'd asked John Bing, who I guess comes from a might get John to introduce himself actually with a bit of his background, but John is a member of the GNSO Council, and I just wanted to understand for the group, for people like me that are engineers and not legal people, what different sorts of dispute models there are, what are the sort of boundary conditions that, from an engineering point of view, I guess, that they need to be able to resolve a dispute. So what information do they need from the parties, that sort of thing. So if you could just sort of give us a bit of a feel for it.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for being permitted to say something about something. I have a tiny little background, but I'm afraid even talking about this little thing, you'll see that I'm inexperienced in knowing all the frames and the backgrounds that we need to address the issues that are relevant. So you'll excuse me for that, but it will perhaps nevertheless be of some small assistance. What I've tried to do is to put together typical dispute resolution models. I should point out that the terminology is used slightly differently between lawyers and between jurisdictions. So they are not necessarily extremely precise as they are presented here, and I'll try to comment that. The first and the obvious thing is negotiations. Negotiations are always based on consent between the parties. You can't have a negotiation if the parties do not agree to negotiate. But the negotiation may be contracted before the dispute, so to say, flowers up. So there may be an obligation to negotiate. The result of the negotiation also have to be accepted by the parties and then will be converted into part of the contract between the parties. And, of course, also, if the negotiations are inconclusive, there is no solution to be found. But with all its weaknesses, this is nevertheless the obvious starting point for any dispute resolution, to get the parties to talk together and see what sort of differences of opinion and what sort of interests are identified as being at stake. And I'm sure most of you have done this more often than you care to remember.
I'll be back.
The second one is mediation, and mediation comes in many flavors. There are strong and weak parts of this type of mediation, but the typical thing is that apart from the parties, there's a third person or persons present. And these are to help the parties to try to identify solutions. They are always based on consent between the parties, though again that consent may be stated in a previous contract, an original contract. And as I say, they are directed by a third party. I call that referee, which is probably widely wrong by technical standards, but you get my point, I'm sure. The point is that those of you who have taken part in the mediation know that it often works like magic. Because the fact that there's a third person present who you have to argue your case for makes you listen to them to a very different way than when you argue them to the person you disagree with. And so therefore it often opens up a psychological room for solutions. And also often the parties are taken into separate rooms, and or even this, it goes over several countries and so on. But nevertheless, the main point is that though the parties may be unwilling to suggest solutions, the referee may propose solutions. And there may be very different reasons for parties not wanting to suggest a solution. Maybe something like covering your own back, or being able to tell your auditor that you tried for the top. You tried to get a better solution, but the referee was the one who came up with this one. So often there may be an underlying interest in reaching a conclusion, but a reluctance to take the first step, and so you have a solution to mediation. Again, it has to be contracted for acceptance. Then you have arbitration. And again, arbitration is something that covers very many different types. The WIPO arbitration for domain names is one typical, one flavor. This is the typical flavor. Typical flavor is that it is an alternative to litigation. And it is based on litigation, legislation. That is, there is a national law which sets out how arbitration is to be organized. And then there is a contract between the parties, very often subject to formalities. And that contract specifies where the arbitration is to be, take place, the law in which the under which the arbitration is to be taking place, and which will govern the proceedings. It is, for instance, typical to use the London Chamber of Commerce or something like that.
So can I? This is something that I struggle to understand. When you're talking about legislation, do you mean there's legislation about how arbitration should happen?
Yes.
Or that's correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And then when you are arbitrating, what basis are they making their decision, I guess?
Well, as you'll see, if it just we'll leave to see on the next slide, just notice here that usually if you choose arbitration and choose the contract of law, the law that is usually accepted by a court. So if you have an arbitration clause in your contract and then you sue, the court will refuse to accept the case and say that it has to go to arbitration.
So the decision is based on if it's to do with a contract. So I have a contract between two parties to build a house or something, and then the arbitration basically is what they're looking at the contract itself and then deciding who's in the right and who's in the wrong against that contract? Is that...
If you take a contract, they'll decide on a forum. That is decided in the contract.
Yep.
Then the forum, the laws of procedure, evidence and so on, will be lifted off from the law of the forum, while the substantive law will be decided either by the contract itself or by the arbitration court. But usually it will be decided by the contract itself. So you, for instance, will have that this contract will be decided by the Chamber of Commerce in London according to Turkish law. And it's very common that the court applies the law of a different country than in which it is situated, and the law of the country in which it is situated.
So you need to take me through that again. So you're saying that they go to an arbitrator in London and then they apply Turkish law.
For instance, yes. So it is very common that the contract specifies a law for the contract which is different from the law of the country in which the forum is located.
Right, now I understand.
But these things can get very complicated, I'm afraid.
So you're saying, if I understand this correctly, you're looking at the contract, and then we're also putting that in the context of the laws of Turkey, for example. Is that what you're saying?
Using your
example.
There's many ways of distinguished law, but one distinguished the law of procedure, which is the law of how to present evidence and who is going to say what when and so on. That is set out in a certain law, and that will be the law of the forum where the court is placed. But then the substantive law, the law that decides who has the right or the wrongs, that can be chosen by the parties, usually chosen in the contract, and that may be different from the law of the forums. And it also should be said that an arbitration court has great freedom in itself to decide how to proceed. And we will come to that in a second. Well, it calls itself arbitration.
No, I'm from WPO, and we don't call up the procedure arbitration, and we do not
No. Well, thank you. As I said, arbitration comes in many flavors. And of course, what WIPO do not have is the basis in the national law. It doesn't. The arbitration is not based on the national law, which sets out the framework, and that is a big difference, as we'll see in a second. Just to take these things, the panel are named according to a procedure which usually set out in the legislation. The parties usually has the control of who is to be named as panelists, but there may be a special rule on how to name the chair, and it may be typical to have three arbitrators. There's no rule. And then comes the two very important thing. The first is that the decision is binding upon the parties. And the third, which is rather unique for arbitration, is that if the arbitration complies with the New York Convention on arbitration and all decisions, it can be executed in any other country which is party to that convention. It's a convention from the 1950s, and nearly all countries are party to that convention. And this has this extreme advantage in our context, that if you are able to actually create an arbitration court which is accepted under the New York Convention, you have an internationally binding decision. And as there is a great deal of freedom in how you do this, you don't have to do it in a traditional way. You may set out that procedure should be by email, maybe one panelist perhaps only, and so on. So I think there's a great deal of potential to be found in this arbitrational strategy, but it has the disadvantage that it needs a legislation in the basis. But legislation is, of course, not too difficult to find. That these are the conventional advantages of arbitration. It's speedy dispute resolution. Only one instance. It's not can't be appealed. You have a control of the expertise brought onto the decision. You have a control of the procedure and the time spent. You have control of the costs, so they will be high usually, often. There's a confidentiality. They are confidential proceedings. And there's international execution if qualified, according to the convention.
John, just a question of clarification. It can be confidential, or it is? It must be.
Well, I don't think it must be, but it can be a confidential. It is opposed to a court case. Under all the democratic countries will have public court cases. It is part of the democratic principles that we should know what the court decides, at least the decision itself, while the arbitration may be completely confidential. I hear name or WIPO, but that is based on contract. It's executed by registrar and do not probably qualify to the New York Convention. And also it may be challenged by national court. And I think the success of the WIPO procedure is very dependent upon the international reputation for WIPO itself, that you don't have more problems with it.
So let's you just go back to that one, because there are other elements that I've heard described about this a little bit as well, and that is that it's it doesn't have any standing in courts either, does it? So in other words, the outcome of that UDRP dispute doesn't count as evidence in terms of the court?
No. I'm sure this is maybe different in different jurisdictions, but if I speak for my own jurisdiction, the WIPO decision would not be binding for a Norwegian party. The Norwegian party might take that to a court. But the court would look at the WIPO decision and say that you must be stupid taking this to the court. You already have a decision from the WIPO, and you know how the reputation of WIPO in this respect. So we will, of course, decide exactly identical to WIPO.
Is there any statistics? I don't know whether Steve would know this or others, but any statistics of decisions that have been from UDRP that have been overturned by court?
Perhaps you know the answer, do you? I do not.
I think I'm very happy that WIPO is on the screen, but I'm not sure if it's really accurate to say that it's a WIPO decision.
though.
It's an ICANN procedure, yeah. And WIPO is a dispute resolution provider, yeah.
Indeed, indeed. But compared,
but it got overturned again, though.
No. But compared to the number of cases that's been solved in this way, it is very, very tiny. And I stand corrected with your observations on the WIPO's role in this. But I think it must be permitted to observe that the reputation of WIPO is a great deal of the explanation that this actually works in practice. I thought I'd mentioned consumer tribunals. These are known in extremely many variations. They work within a territory. They usually are disputed mechanisms based on self-regulation. They often are supported by the government, and they are seen as alternative to court proceedings. They're simplified and low-cost procedures. They are not binding, but by consensus in the market, they are followed usually, and they can only be upheld, enforced within the jurisdiction. There has been attempts to introduce something like consumer tribunals for the electronic market in Europe. As far as I know, they have not been successful, but there have been attempts.
Question, John. So would this only apply if the two parties, in the case of applicants for new TLD, were from the same jurisdiction?
Yes, I think so. It would be something like, let's take Dot Travel. There's travel agencies, and as you know, people travel on holidays, and they often do not find that their quality was as they expected. Go to a court case would be extremely expensive, so that is not really an option. But in order to keep the customers happy, the travel agencies are banded together and offer a dispute resolution system. So a disgruntled customer can take the case to this tribunal, and it'll settle it, and the travel agencies will follow it. And, of course, you could follow the same model for instance, a dispute resolution mechanism for a country domain or another domain. Or a top-level domain. It's a question of self-regulation, so you you only regulate yourself, and as you are willing to accept the decisions, the question of enforcement does not arise. Comes. This is, of course, the general example. That is litigation. And a party which a qualified interest in the dispute may take a civil action before the courts. In the qualified interest, there is a certain reality. The court will typically upheld contractual clauses, including arbitration clauses, choice of forum, choice of law, etc. But the decisions can only be executed within the territory, as you know, with the exception of conventions which make national decisions enforceable outside the territory. So there is, among many countries, often bilateral decisions that civil decisions can be enforced outside the territory. But there's no general system. And this is expensive, and it has usually three tiers. First instance, appeal court and Supreme Court. It takes time, and it often is expensive, and it is completely off scale for the type of disputes that we are. This is the small claims court. I just wanted to mention that, because that is something that some of you may know for within your own countries. Again, they come in an extremely wide variety of variations, but they're designed to settle small claims, money claims, for 1,000 euro or something like that. And it is rather obvious for all involved that it would be wouldn't be appropriate to go to a full-fledged court proceedings for that. On the other side, it would be wouldn't be too good if you weren't able to pursue your claim. So there's variations of small claim courts. They may be special tribunals, or there may be special procedures before the general courts, and there are many examples of they being nearly completely computerized. So there's a computer system deciding whether you should have your small claim or not. And I tried to set out some of the challenges of string evaluation. And one of the problems is, of course, that those who disagree may not be bound by contract. And so you can't rely on their contract to govern how this dispute is to be solved. A second problem is that the courts of several countries may have jurisdiction at the same time. Third problem may be that whether you can enforce a decision will depend on a presence within the jurisdiction. So if a court may have jurisdiction over the conflict, but one of the parties of the conflict doesn't own anything in that jurisdiction, and so it doesn't really help very much. I think this is, of course, only my own uncertainty, but I'm uncertain to the relation between ICANN policies and contracts, and I hope they will be respected and taken into account if you don't have a contract to fall back on between the parties. And then you have the recognition of these decisions by alternative dispute resolutions, which in practice will rely on, as in the WIPO case, their reputation and on a consensus, international consensus, to take them into account. And there exists very few examples of civil courts of an international nature. There are treaties which introduce dispute resolution, but that is not typical for treaties. Treaties are, to some extent, gentlemen's agreements. And that is one of the things that has been seen as lacking in treaties. So, World Trade Organization has a dispute resolution with teeth, but that is only between states. So there is no, as I can see it, obvious alternative to model such dispute resolutions on. But I only had a few days to develop this, and there might be the International Chamber of Commerce might provide some interesting experience, but I haven't looked at that.
Could I just ask a clarification on your last slide? When you say there's not a contract, it's not initiated by a contract, but in theory, it could be a condition of applying for a string would be that you would agree to a certain dispute resolution procedure, and you would agree to be bound by it, and so forth. And
certainly. So the applicant could be bound, but the one who is opposing it.
Yes.
Yeah, will not.
That's right.
Yeah, he will.
It would in the case of string contention where two are seeking the same one.
Indeed.
But other than that, you're right.
I did try to make a chart, but that probably hasn't made it over. But make a chart of the possibilities. And I think if you're able to structure about 24 different scenarios, or exactly 24 different scenarios, because it's rather different whether the conflict is between two government agencies, between the government and the private agency within the same jurisdiction or outside the same jurisdiction, and whether they are for either to stop a string or to have a string which people want to restrict, or to transfer the ownership of a string. So altogether, I think this comes up to 24 different solutions or categories, and one could discuss them for each category. What would be the appropriate dispute resolution mechanism for that category? And I did make that rather complex and certain chart only to indicate that perhaps some of the discussion that I have seen may have been too simplified, that it looks upon it like it was one type of conflict, but there really is, at least as our small discussion brought out, at least more than one type of conflict.
If I just sort of, let's just take one particular dispute, which is confusingly similar. And the parties are ICANN, it's located in the United States. It could be the applicant, wherever they're located, and the complainant, wherever they're located. Is one approach basically to say that we're going to use a particular US law to govern that decision, and then the... Because I gather what you're trying to do is... You mentioned that you might go to the international... some arbitrator in the United Kingdom, and then you say that the law of Turkey applies. So we sort of... It's essentially you have to identify the law first, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would say, okay, just say, for example, I just chose because ICANN is located in the US, I'll use the law of the US. It could be the arbitration might happen outside of it.
But I think that ICANN nearly like reflects... Someone will tell me this, but they introduced California as the forum, a Californian law as the law governing the contract. So if you have a contract, it will be decided by Californian law.
Yeah. So another that's right. So the registry agreement is that your understanding, Chuck? Well, I suppose it doesn't matter because you're in the US anyway, although you're not in California. Yeah, but you'd be bound by, the contract itself is bound by the law of California, is that right? The .com, yeah. So if you use US law, I suppose, is the foundation for the dispute.
Yeah, of course.
And then you're saying, okay, so we're going to use US law, or maybe we'd be even more specific as Californian law or federal law or whatever, because that's where the... John's shaking his head. Am I getting this? You can't do federal. You have to do a state, right. Explain that. Why is that? All right. So
it's basically because matters of contract are matters of state law in the U.S. For the most part, it's not a federal law of contract.
Okay. So, okay.
With some exceptions, but if you and I enter into a contract, even if it's if we end up in federal court, they're probably going to apply the law of the state about how you interpret the contract and so forth.
Right. So I'm just trying to sort of get the flow. If I'm doing confusingly similar for a second. So what am I saying? What's the contract? The contract, I suppose, that we're binding here is there's a contract between the applicant and ICANN is if you like, the contract that you sign when you submit your application. So I have a contract between the applicant and ICANN, and then I'm saying that this contract is going to be in California. Is the law of that contract, and then I'm going to deal with a dispute on that contract, which basically says the string can't be confusingly similar, I suppose. So that's probably a matter of contract. And then what are we saying that we're applying some US law of the definition of confusingly similar? Is that how
you could do that? You could refer. Basically, any time there's going to be an arbitration or any other decision maker, they need to know what law are they supposed to apply or what standards are they supposed to apply.
And that's what I'm trying to get at, because in the way
it could be specified in the contract that you would apply, you know, in determining whether it's confusingly similar, the decision maker will apply X law.
Right. Yeah. Ken?
Maybe Mike can explain this better than I can. Or help me out here. I was sued as chairman of CORE by someone, and they were able to take the court into the jurisdiction into California on the basis that CORE had a contract with ICANN as an accredited registrar. So it would seem to me that if the contract for the application is a California contract between ICANN and the party who's applied, that the same basic laws would provide for anything to be dealt with. It was the Ninth District Court, Keller, here in Los Angeles, so I'm guessing that would, you know, I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was in federal court, and based upon, as Steve had mentioned, it is possible to go into federal court if you meet certain criteria, diversity of citizenship, also minimum amounts in question. So those are some of the criteria that you need to tick off the boxes prior to being able to file a claim in federal court. However, as Steve mentioned, generally federal courts will apply state law in interpreting the contractual provisions. Now, the one thing that I think, Bruce, you raised is, does an applicant subject themselves to jurisdiction under California law by purposely availing themselves of submitting?
Yeah, they're signing the application to do so. Yeah, I think that's what we're trying to get at. We're making them bound by the process by agreeing to. Just as if I'm signing a registry agreement, I'm bound by that process at the point I sign the registry agreement. We're saying this is effectively like an application agreement, which then defines how it would operate.
Just a question, isn't that a separate issue? We were just talking about whether the string confusability question needed or not a reference as to what law to use, and that is not certain in my mind. It could be something that is a concept that is, I was told, used in construction in Germany, which is called Schiedsgutachten, which is actually called binding opinion in some cases in English. Basically, just an expert is going to be named, and that expert advice is going to be binding. You know, he's going to decide. That's it. And this does not necessarily have a reference to a law, right? Because, you know, confusing is still a linguistic problem.
Yeah. So this is fundamentally, and we're going to run out of time, but this is really, you know, there needs to be work done on this before the council can sign off on this whole process. I want someone who's an expert in this area to map this out for me, basically. But, you know, do I need a law or not is really my question, and you're saying I don't. Amadeo, you had a comment?
It depends.
Yeah. I'm trying to deal with confusingly similar, just one of our many disputes, yeah, right? How am I going to set up a process for dealing with confusingly similar?
Okay. Now, I think that confusingly similar is the simplest case. We will have lots of problems with all the other things like I oppose VeriSign running .bank,
yep,
because I am the bank, something like that. But there's the simpler one.
Yeah, start with the simple one.
Exactly. The simpler one being confusingly similar. I don't think we need to say anything regarding reference to the governing law, because probably there is no way to define which is the governing law. It's very clear in the case that you have both companies in one location, under one jurisdiction. It's very simple for an activity that's physically located in one area. But that's most probably not the case we'll face.
Assume that's not. Yeah.
So look at what happens at the UDRP.
Yeah.
There is no reference to the law that's applied. There are the principles. You know, this is confusingly similar. Then you judge. And indeed, in case that both parties belong to a legal system, you will interpret that according to the general principles of that legal system. It's a legal tradition. You use, you know, the common understandings in that, you know, legal systems that share some common principles. And if not, there is some, let's say, shared principles worldwide regarding what is confusing, what's similar, and what's a trademark, but are, you know, weaker levels. And I think that here we can't move from that. So we simply send an expert to see whether, as a matter of fact, this is confusingly similar, taking, you know, all these principles that come from the legal system, but not applying the legal concept of confusingly similar in a given jurisdiction, because we don't know beforehand. We will never know beforehand.
Right. So Amadeo, and I'll go to John in a second, I just want to understand what you're saying. So basically, in this agreement, I basically say that one of my criteria for getting a string is it's not confusingly similar.
Yep.
And then it goes to a dispute process. So the dispute process says, here's a contract between these two parties. one of the criteria in the contract is the string is not confusingly similar. I suppose that makes ICANN part of that dispute process, which is what I was thinking we're trying to avoid. Because UDRP doesn't involve ICANN nor the registrar. It's
Quite frankly, for confusingly similar, I will smile to WIPO and say, you could handle that. This is what you do all the time for domain names, WIPO and NAF and others. But WIPO fraud has, you know, most of the cases, I mean, in nearly all the cases when you have applicants from different jurisdictions, right? Which is not the case very often for NAF arbitration cases, sorry, UDRP cases or the asset dispute resolution of outside that area. So, once again, is, you know, you say the legal concept is the decision, but this just simply remits you to a question of fact. Confusion is a question of fact in this case, and all the tests are factual cases. Will people be misled, misguided? You know, you apply different sets of criteria here. And the important thing is that someone from outside decides this with all the evidence and all the arguments and all the usual tests. It's not saying beforehand which exactly are the tests you will need to apply, because they are the ones applied by this concrete judge at federal level in the United States or in Germany or wherever. I repeat, we don't know where the applicants will be. So,
you're saying we're okay. And John, do you want to respond to that? Is that making sense?
Yes, it makes sense in the way. Let me say a few things. In the United States, people have a great deal of experience in these matters, but the experience is taken from a large jurisdiction divided into small jurisdictions, and our problems is slightly different because we do not live within this big federal jurisdiction and make a choice in between it. We have to do it a different way. But I think that in your question, there is a simple strategy. And that strategy is to say that if anybody approaches ICANN, the first thing he or she does or it does is to do a pre-contract which govern the contractual negotiations, right? So you first, before you're permitted to enter into contracting, you do a pre-contracting which governs exactly things like you mentioned. And so if you will have a discussion on confusingly similar, you have a simple but authoritative way of doing it. For instance, an extremely wise person or an extremely well reputational organization which is qualified in that contract and which easily can be activated, speedily make the decision at a low cost. And that is it. And it's governed by the contract,
right.
and that confusingly similar can, as mentioned, can be an independent concept. It doesn't have to be a concept which is derived from any jurisdiction. It can be built up through experience within that system.
And so, to deal with the issue that the complainant is is not bound by that process, let me just see if I understand how that works. Unless you say that the basis of challenge is you have to do the equivalent of that agreement, otherwise you can't challenge. I suppose that's another way of looking at it. In other words, your only other option then is to go to court.
Yeah, I don't think I would go down the road that you're waived from additional claims later on, but ICANN's deciding whether to approve or not approve an application.
Yes.
And ICANN would set out the guidelines saying, in order to approve the application, if there's some kind of string contention or some kind of objection, this is the process we're going to go by. The applicant will sign on to that.
Yep.
Anyone who wants to challenge it could use that process as a vehicle.
Right.
And then ICANN, assuming that it rejects the opposition and grants the string, that party could still raise a lawsuit later on.
And then
they're not waived. And then it just goes through the court process, right?
Yeah. So you're not saying that you would do some sort of thing by a complainant using our process. They agree not to take any further action. You're saying not to do that.
Right.
And why is that?
Because, again, you have the contractual issue where the complainant doesn't sign on to that process, and then you want to encourage them to participate in that.
If I'm going to waive my right,
I'm not going to participate in some jurisdiction that I'm not comfortable participating in. If I know that's my only shot, I'm going to go straight to my court that I'm comfortable with.
Okay. Mike?
And the reality is, since the ultimate inclusion of a TLD into the Route A zone, so zone file is going to involve action by the U.S. government approving the recommendation and then changing it. Since that's located in the U.S.,
it's ultimately going to be the jurisdiction.
It's potentially, I would argue, yeah. A trademark owner who has lost at every other tick box potentially will look at dilution. Yeah. They will potentially file a federal claim of dilution seeking the halting of adding that TLD to the zone. So there's, I think what John...
So they could go for a, what do you call it?
Injunction, TRO.
Injunction. So we just let that process happen.
I said, totally outside. But I think what John is saying is people will be very concerned about ticking a box where they waive their rights. So I think that's a very valid point.
Yeah. Okay. I've got to go. But I think that's been useful. It's helped sort of clarify some of these different methods, and I think we really need to articulate in the report, just map this out a little bit more so people understand how these dispute processes would work and some examples, I guess, before June. Olaf.
Talking about it, I recalled once the European Telecommunications Platform made a pretty lengthy overview over various dispute resolution procedures and bodies, and I could send that to the list for the avid readers among you.
Yeah, please do. I think that would be helpful. So what was that, Olaf?
That is an overview made by the European Telecommunications Platform, a little association which I was deeply involved in once upon a time. I actually launched it. So 5 years ago, I think they made an overview of various dispute resolution procedures and bodies, of course, in the context of, primarily interconnection disputes, but not only that. But it's much more general than that, and I think it could be useful if you look at the latest 50 pages or so of it.
Okay, that'd be great. So we'll get John's presentation sent round, and if you can send that round as well, Olaf, I think it would be good. I'd certainly benefit from reading that and trying to understand what all these eminent legal experts on our council and committees already understand. Okay, good. Well, thank you, everyone. That's the end of today's proceedings. And we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks.